I need to make a confession here. I am very remorseful for having almost forgotten to do a little sketch on one of the most important people in my life as a jazz musician, and one of the most important people in the evolution of jazz as an art form and jazz education and so many other areas that encompass jazz music and American culture. He's not a household name. He's been gone for a while and we've forgotten him. So I'm gonna bring him to the front. We're talking about Dr. Billy Taylor. This is very personal to me because I met the man a few times. Always elegant, always kind, always humble, and always brilliant. Billy Taylor was born in 1921 in Greenville. I say Greenville because that's where they say it in North Carolina. They don't say Greenville, they say Greenville. Greenville, North Carolina in 1921. But of course, Greenville was kind of rustic and rural and agricultural, a lot of pigs and chickens and that kind of thing. So just like in Beverly Hillbillies, his family had to get away from there. So they moved up to Washington, D.C., yeah, the nation's capital. And when Billy got there, he was happy. He started learning to play this instrument that he played, drums and guitar and the saxophone. And he finally settled on the piano somewhere around 13. He said, well, this is the one that worked for me. And it worked. And he was taking lessons. Family supported him. They gave him some theory lessons and classical piano lessons with Henry Grant. I know what you're thinking, well, who is Henry Grant? Well, Henry Grant was Duke Ellington's piano teacher and a legend in Washington, D.C. Henry Grant, go look him up. You'll be shocked by that man too. So Billy Taylor had a good start. Washington, D.C., studying theory and classical piano at a young age in a very disciplined fashion, because Henry Grant was no joke, baby. You did it or you paid. Later on, Billy Taylor wasn't so convinced that music was going to be his thing, so when it got time for him to graduate from high school, there was no doubt what he was going to do. You see, he was also an academic. So rather than going to New York like Duke did, or go to a trade school like Duke did, oh no, Billy Taylor decided, I'm going to college. So he goes to Virginia State and he majors in sociology. He's very good with his sociology, straight A student, you know. Until someone in the music faculty heard him playing the piano and goes, we ain't wasting you on no sociology, boy. Come here, you're gonna be a music major. And 2 years later, Billy Taylor graduated from Virginia State with a degree in music. And then he goes to New York. New York, New York, the Big Apple. Yeah, this little country boy from Greenville. Thank God he stopped in Washington, D.C., so he knew a little bit about city life, and he's following in the footsteps of Duke Ellington. And he shows up on the scene right during the swing era and just before bebop, and he met Art Tatum, and Art Tatum was his mentor and showing him all the stride piano, all the fast licks. Of course, Billy could do that because he had all that classical training and whatnot. And of course, he had all the harmonic technique because he had studied, you know, Debussy and all that, so he knew about the harmonies and whatnot. So he was all ready to go when the new thing happened, and the new thing was bebop. And there was Billy Taylor. He was ready to do it. Yes, he was. But as soon as he got to New York, you see, he could play. And Ben Webster, who was one of the baddest cats around saxophone, decided, I want you, son. You play good. I want you to join my band. So he joined Ben Webster's band, and then he had to leave New York. Matter of fact, he had to leave America like a lot of jazz musician did, especially black jazz musician did in this point in time with all this racial stuff that was going on at that time, still going on now. Yeah, that stuff. Okay, he left. They go to Europe. He likes it, but he got to come back. So he comes back and he plays a while in New York, and then he had a chance to go back to Europe. The Netherlands, which I love, really. So peaceful, people so great, feel like a man. And France, Paris, which I love for the same reasons. Benny, by this time, is married. And so when the band came back to the States, Benny is like, I ain't ready to go home. I'm gonna stay in Europe a little bit longer so I can flex, give me a little freedom. I like it. And his wife agreed. So they stayed in Europe for a while. But eventually, he had to come on back home, and he did. And finding gigs was easy for him. He was playing at the Royal Roost, which was one of the clubs I profiled some time ago during the bebop era, one of the hot bebop clubs. And soon, he became pianist at Birdland. You've heard of Birdland, right? Yeah, he was at Birdland. Not only was he playing at Birdland, he was the house pianist, which means he's running things at Birdland. And he held the job at Birdland longer than any single musician ever did. Who is Dr. Billy Taylor? This is who Dr. Billy Taylor is. During that time, at Birdland, of course, you can't have Birdland, there's birds there. So Charlie Parker is coming through, and Dizzy Gillespie is coming through, and Miles Davis is coming through, and J.J. Johnson is coming through, and Stan Getz is coming through. And he's playing with all of them, they're just loving it. You know, they never said a whole lot about a whole lot of piano players coming through there. Because although we've heard of Thelonious Monk, and we've heard of Bert Powell, we've heard of all these cats, they didn't want no part of Billy Taylor over there at the Birdland. They felt better over there at Minton's. They didn't need none of that Birdland stuff because Billy Taylor was laying it down. But see, Billy Taylor had this restless mind. And he really cared very much for education, being an educated man himself. So somewhere in the 50s, although he's composing, he's a band leader, he's doing this, he's doing that, he turns his attention to education. And he starts doing clinics and lecturing and writing books. I think he referred to himself as an urban griot. I'm gonna tell the story of urban life and the music of urban people, which is jazz and black folks, or people of color, whatever you want, you know, whatever you all got going out there right now. But he's telling the story. And of course, he's telling it with great truth and power, and he's being very articulate in that he was this marvelously articulate, educated man. Now, that should have been enough, not for Billy Taylor. He's got to keep doing stuff. So next thing you know, he's working for NBC, and he's got broadcasting going on. He wants to spread this jazz around. He wins an Emmy for broadcasting a show on jazz, the first show ever on jazz. He wins an Emmy. And then another television series on jazz. He becomes the first black band leader on a talk show when David Frost hired him to be his band leader in 1969. He stayed with David Frost for 3 or 4 years. running that band and hiring other jazz musicians, Count Basie, Dizzy Gillespie. He was bringing black jazz musicians, jazz musicians in general, to the American public through your TV. He is now becoming the Johnny Appleseed of jazz and jazz education. This man is passionate about what he is doing, and he's doing what he does at a high level. Is he done? No, he is not, because he is also a composer. And one of the songs he wrote probably has something to do with his experiences in Europe. He wrote a song called "I Wish I Knew What It Felt Like to Be Free." I wish I knew what it felt like to be free. This song became a rallying cry for the civil rights movement during the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s. One of the greatest recordings of it is done by Nina Simone. I recommend it highly. Very passionate. I wish I knew what it felt like to be free. Sing that song today. Nothing has changed. And Biddy wrote that song almost 70 years ago, and it still stands today because that's Biddy Taylor. He continued to work with trios and big groups and orchestras and tour and do all the things he did. But he wasn't done. He started teaching at colleges. He worked at the Kennedy Center, and he worked at Manhattan School of Music, and he worked at Eastern Carolina, and he worked at this university and that university. He did these film strips in the late 60s that talked about what jazz is. And he took common songs, Mary Had a Little Lamb, and then jazz them up with a jazz combo to show young people what jazz was. Jazz is not the name of a song. Jazz is an approach to performing. And he talked about the element of swing and the element of improvisation. And he did it in these little film strips in a way that even a little kid could get it and will want to go out there and improvise and get involved in jazz. How do I know? Because I used those film strips when I was first starting to teach in the very early 70s. My kids loved them. Biddy Taylor was masterful in his carrying the message of jazz education. Was he done? No, he wasn't done. He went back to school because he just wanted more. And he did not just get his master's, he did not stop until he received his PhD in 1975. Why? I don't know. He already had 5 or 6 honorary doctorates. He was already a doctor. He didn't need to earn a PhD to have the title. He earned a PhD because of that quest for knowledge that he had in his heart and in his spirit, and to empower himself to do bigger and greater things. And what about his heart? I talk about his heart. He started a foundation for jazz musicians who have no safety net. A jazz musician gets sick, he probably doesn't have much health insurance. Be in trouble. Dizzy did the same thing around New York for musicians. Biddy Taylor did it. And after Katrina, his foundation helped to buy instruments, clothing, food, and even housing for musicians around New Orleans and all over this country who were suffering from losses as a result of whatever hardships musicians experienced. Biddy Taylor provided a safety net for jazz musicians that he knew that did not have the wherewithal to go back to college and achieve these degrees and work in colleges and universities and have that financial safety net that he had. Did he stop there? No, he kept performing. And even in 2002, when he suffered a bad stroke and lost movement, some movement in that right hand, the filigree hand, he didn't stop. He continued to perform right up until his death at 89 years of age in 2010. He just wouldn't stop. Now, I first met Billy Taylor right after he had achieved his PhD in the late 70s in Erie, Pennsylvania. I was doing work for PBS, a local affiliate there in Erie, Pennsylvania, and I was called to do an interview with Billy Taylor, who was doing a concert with the Erie Philharmonic Orchestra. That will be a whole other conversation about the social dynamics between orchestras, classical musicians, and jazz musicians. Another whole conversation. I went there with my good friend Bob Hoff, Dr. Bob Hoff, a PhD in psychology, my best friend when I was up in Erie. And we interviewed Dr. Billy Taylor in his hotel room. And it was funny, he could hardly talk to us because he had bought one of the very first little portable keyboards. We almost call them toys now. But in the late 70s, this was like something from outer space. And he had it in his hotel room, and he was playing with it, and he thought it was the most exciting thing in the world. He says, this little thing right here is gonna open the world up to a whole nother dimension in music. And he was just so excited about it. And I'm looking at this thing going, it don't look very much to me. And Bob Hoff, who was not really a musician, just a music lover, went, I don't see what he sees in that. Well, Billy Taylor was a lot smarter than us. Because as you know, here we are now, you can't do anything without electronics. And electronic keyboards run the world. Ask Alan Sams. Hey Alan, how you doing? That's right, Billy Taylor, baby. And so we completed the interview. It was broadcast, it was great. He was I have to find that tape sometime. I'm sure Steve wants to hear it. I didn't see him for a while. And then I heard he was coming to Clearwater once I moved here. And I went out to see him that night, do a concert in Clearwater at a piano warehouse, as a matter of fact. And the amazing thing is the band he had with him there included Victor Gaskin, the great bass player. And it was exactly the same band that I had seen in Erie, Pennsylvania 20 years earlier. He was also very loyal to his band members. He liked to have a situation that was comfortable and well known for him so he could experiment and improvise freely and know that he had a supporting cast. I then found out that the young Clay Perry, who grew up here, who's a great producer in Nashville now, was a part of a clinic that Dr. Taylor did at PCCA earlier that day. So although Billy Taylor had a performance that night, that did not stop him from waking up early and going into a high school and talking to a group of young kids. Because from the middle to the end of his life, his greatest passion was education, spreading the good news of jazz. And he was a bad cat. He could play his butt off. And he was a composer. And he was a broadcaster. Winning Peabody Awards, Emmy Awards, you name it. Dr. Billy Taylor is someone that we should never forget because he has contributed so much to us. As Leonard Feather, the great noted jazz writer, said, there is no doubt that Billy Taylor during his life was the most passionate spokesman for the importance of jazz and education that the world had ever seen. Thank you, Dr. Billy Taylor. And thank you for listening.